All right. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming to the session. This session is about really a business view on social, right? So it's in the business track, and it's probably going to be the least technical session of SharePoint Conference. Just want to set the right expectations here. So I saw that as a speaker, we get those very helpful statistics. I saw that half of you have declared themselves to be IT professionals. This might be a really interesting session to you. On the other hand, don't punish me if you're finding it not technical enough. My name is Moritz Berger. I work as a business architect at Microsoft within this global sales organization. And so I'm looking at my background, at how I came to be your presenter for today, is really from two sides. One is I'm looking after our SharePoint and Yammer products and how we bring those to market from a sales and services and partner perspective. So I'm heavily invested into that. And that's a good reason to be here. The other one is that as part of my job description, this is kind of difficult to figure out what I do for a living, looking just at the title, right? So what I do is I build new organizational capabilities and I grow existing capabilities. And out of that, what we are starting to see now is that really social is becoming a very useful part of our portfolio in how we're thinking about how long it's going to take us to accomplish certain business objectives, how do we go about it, what are the necessary steps to get going, and those things. So before I dive into the presentation, really the claim to fame for social, for me recently, my most impressive hands-on experience has been the integration with our Yammer subsidiary, where we were able to do a significant amount of integration and really get to that first milestone where we have some operational coexistence and synergies within 10 weeks after the acquisition closed. And that is because we were able to take advantage of the technology to enable that business context where there was just no prerequisite to have a common Active Directory if you wanted to communicate with somebody. There was no prerequisite to know if you had something to discuss with HR, to know who that person would be. If you had a shared concern between sales and finance on both sides, right? You didn't have to figure out who you should, you were supposed to talk to. You could just use hashtags, and then very likely somebody who you weren't even aware of, that they were also interested in the issue. They could jump in, and everything was really flowing in almost real time, and that was a very, very impressive experience. So for me, this question that I'm sure a lot of you are still have in the back of your heads, what is the value of social? To me, I would really say, in particular after that experience, that I do not require further proof. But let's take a look at, again, at the goals for this session. What I'm trying to do is on my journey to where I'm at right now, and I've not come to an end yet, right? So trying to understand how to utilize social and get some useful input to stimulate my thought processes and the way that I'm working on implementations, I've come across a couple useful things that I want to share with you. So this is not a definitive answer to all your questions, but the hope is really that you will know better which questions to ask or what aspects to look at and what to take advantage of to get you to where you need to be faster as an outcome of this session. The non-goals, and this is kind of part of the Microsoft engineering culture, right? If you write a feature for SharePoint, you try and make explicit what it's not meant to be. This is not really a social consulting approach, so it's not tightly packaged up to end-to-end, and so it's not a script, not a playbook for you all. It doesn't talk about general SharePoint adoption. There are excellent sessions on that, right? This isn't even the only social session I want you to attend. If you just go to this session, very likely you will have a very incomplete view of things. So I'd encourage you to go to some of the others as well. And so very definitively, this is not about bits and bytes. So the only technology thing involved in getting us here was when I just jumped into my browser to my SkyDrive Pro and pulled down this deck onto this PC. That's the extent of it. Okay, let's move on. So what are your goals? Let's try and make this real, right? I don't know. I mean, this is maybe an opportunity to do a quick show of hands. Who here is actively pursuing a no email initiative? Okay, a couple of hands go up. So bad news for you. Gartner just said in their hype cycle that just came out that this is obsolete before reaching the plateau. So it might still be viable for some of you. I'm not saying that it isn't, but it's kind of interesting why, when some of us thought it had a lot of promise, why is there a mainstream opinion that says that it was a nice idea, but somehow it didn't quite work out. And then you can get as extreme as our friend Ed Bott here, and you can really go all in on social and really apply that to the way that the House of Representatives works in this country. So this was more of a joke. But, at first, some of us thought that no email initiatives were kind of a joke. So what are your goals? Where do you want to be? This is just really to get us started. This is a bit of well-known stuff, but then a couple of ideas that you might not have seen before. So starting out, paying tribute to Andrew Carnegie, and he was really ahead of his time, right? So this is like more than 100 years ago. He had this view, and interestingly, in the steel industry, where if you think about commoditized industries where the majority of workers are really engaged not in information work or knowledge processes, he actually started seeing that there are gains to be had by making sure that the knowledge that exists with some people, that finds its way into the hands or rather minds of some others who might be able to take advantage of it. And so he saw that as a very, very fundamental thing to maximize his return on equity. Interestingly, so that's kind of Andrew Carnegie's perspective is one of productivity. Here's another one. And this is actually one of my favorite books of all time, so I might be slightly biased and a fanboy. Max Boisseau wrote a very influential work, and I'll give you a reading list after the end of this session. But what he came up with is really this construct of information spaces and how to think about knowledge over time. And he had a really great point there that actually while social has this promise of making knowledge more broadly accessible, the highest value in knowledge is only as long as you can keep it tightly confined and highly proprietary. And then over time, you have this effect of dispersion where it makes its way into the mainstream, but then all of a sudden it becomes less valuable. So you have to start the cycle anew, and you have to go through taking that personal knowledge and moving it into an asset for your organization, keeping it proprietary as long as you can. So it's kind of it's an interesting point of view where it's not all about sharing everything as broadly as you can, because then again you're killing value. It's a very delicate walk, understanding that knowledge does not have a stable state in this continuum. So what the proprietary information of 20 years ago, if you think about the car industry, not every car had an airbag, right? There was a lot of proprietary technology in there, and today it's commonplace, but then it's no longer a differentiator. So that is interesting. Again, this is just briefly, this is preaching to the choir, I guess. Knowledge work, interestingly, is increasing, and there are some trends that really go back over the last century, that go back into after World War II, and it's really a steadily monotonous growth of knowledge work. In the U.S., the percentage is way above 60% of knowledge work and knowledge impact. So that is interesting. And then, most interestingly at all, and in this conversation really started to get a lot of attention with the economic crisis in 08 and 09, when a lot of our organizations had to look at things like cash flow and the viability of the company. So there's just a lot of change afoot, right? The complexity of work goes up. The nature of the supply chain, the nature of your industry that you're in, you might be moving, like in the pharma industry, you might be moving from a centralized model to a heavily distributed model just to deal with the fact that to invent a new drug, it's getting so expensive that you have to find a way to crowdsource, to share out some of the risk in developing new drugs. So complexity is going up. End-user expectations are going up, consumerization of IT. You do have to deal with that new breed of people almost, not quite, right? The change in demographics, the millennials, they provide a great stimulus to your organization, but they have completely different skills and requirements compared to the older segments of your workforce. These social media are becoming very, very commonplace. And then on the other hand, you still have a lot of people who are not fully bought into the big picture. Again, back to the 08, 09 conversations, common objection was, hey, I just laid off a bunch of people. Those who remain should just be grateful that they still have a job. I'm not investing into keeping them happy beyond that. So why do I need social for? Right? And then the behavior, we all are stuck in our ways. At Microsoft, I believe the average number of emails that you're getting if you work for Microsoft per day is 400. So somebody claims that Microsoft is the most email-heavy company on the planet. If you're getting more than 400 per day on average in your organization, I would love to exchange notes with you after the session. So, but there's a lot of behavior. We're just a reply all. That's just part of the culture. Then there's actually this can be critical and can kill your social initiative. There's always the element of power, loss of power. Do we really want to be more transparent? Is there a willingness to do so? And then there's, of course, the legacy in existing systems and processes, which just prescribe certain ways of working that are not yet socially aware or enabled. So a couple things coming together. A very humanistic point of view, right? So given all that, we have a unique advantage to get more mileage out of our people, to put it into very capitalist terms. And then this is probably all of us or most of us. This is just a personal perspective. I'm supposed to get the job done. I'm struggling to find the information I need and the people to work with, and even to figure out what my job is all about today or what it's supposed to be all about, right? There's a lot of ambiguity in a lot of our roles. So getting back to the stuff that you don't know. Thus far, just a brief recap. Some older research, and you'll see that, amazingly, some of the things that are valuable and that you should take into consideration go back to the 1940s, effectively, in some of the research done back then. So this is an observation that doesn't necessarily apply today. This is pre-email. So Tom Allen, he found that if you are more than 16.6 meters apart, 50 feet, so I'm doing a conversion for those of you who are not from the U.S., then if somebody else is farther apart in that from where you sit physically, your likelihood of engaging with them on work-related matters is less than 10% on a weekly basis. So that's kind of an indicator of disconnectedness. On the other hand, if you are very tightly connected to somebody, let's say you're sitting next to somebody else and you're chatting 4 hours a day, and so you really know what they're all about and what they're doing, then effectively you have the inverse phenomenon. So one was, okay, there's too much distance, but actually if you're too close, then, well, it's very hard to differentiate yourself from them in terms of the ideas that you would come up with, because you're looking at the same known facts, you kind of have the same background, so you reach similar conclusions, and that's not necessarily a stimulus for innovation. So this is really what's called the value or the strength of weak ties. That is, there's specific value in being able to reach out across the aisle to talk to somebody who has a different background than you have and really seek for that cross-pollination and get a different perspective to be able to make progress. So this is interesting, right? So you have the state of not enough communication, too much communication, and then you have this interesting in-between where actually there's value in being able to reach out. Okay, so we have a disconnect here today. Actually, the problem of weak ties versus strong ties is a nice one to have, because arguably in a lot of organizations you have the issue of no ties. You can look at technology. Technology is super interesting as a factor, where you have these other technologies, and sometimes the question is, aren't those really equivalent to what we now call social, right? If you think about discussion lists in public folders in Exchange. Oh, now I said something, because it's kind of an inside joke if you have been with Microsoft for a while, where are public folders going? So there is a gap where we don't have the ideal way of achieving, of going after some of these connection issues using the legacy technologies. And again, speeding up a little bit here on what you already know, social computing is certainly a game changer. This is important to keep in mind, right? It just feels different from your SAP GUI. And it's very democratic, and Facebook has more than 1 billion users, and so on and so forth. So it is a big game changer. And ultimately, this is a nice picture to put in your minds. We can have groups that operate with a birthday party's informality and a multinational scope. So that's kind of, wow, if we could do that, certainly we would have taken care of a lot of the things that I just talked about. Okay, so a lot of really pie-in-the-sky objectives, and so I would encourage you to look at it as a substantial project, right? So this is similar to landing a man on the moon. Maybe there's also an easier side of it. So this is actually an important disclaimer. From here on out in this talk, I will focus on the things that you don't get for free, on the stuff that's not obvious, on where I'm asking you to do something and where effort is required. One of the nice aspects of social is that you're getting a lot for free. You're getting a lot out of voluntary engagement. And the energy that's with your workforce, within your organization, that will carry you a long way, right? So this is why half of the equation is really okay, but how to make sure that you succeed and how to amplify the impact. But in half of it, there's a lot that makes social unique and that will help you, and that makes it maybe less difficult than a moon landing or a Mars colony. Okay, principles. Very simple, very friendly pictures. So thinking about user engagement. Clearly, without user engagement, social is not going to work, right? So I've been guilty of this myself. I just created a new Yammer group 3 weeks ago, and I invited a bunch of my colleagues, and all the subsequent conversations happened on email. So fail. Apparently, I wasn't able to attract them, right? So they saw the Yammer group, but because I didn't seed it, I didn't have enough critical mass in there to get going, it was just my idea, they didn't like it enough to eventually act. So I wasn't able to go past that. And maybe I should have bribed some of them to join me in the effort, and that would have created a pull on the other ones. So user engagement is critical. If you don't get it, you will just fail. So, and that puts you right in the bootstrap problem of adoption. Apologies for the ugly sketch, but this shows you that it's authentic, right? I didn't steal it from somebody who has better design talents than I have. So what it comes down to is really, if you think about relevance, right? What we saw is see, like, act. What it comes down to is it relevant enough for me? Do I want to engage? Do I like what I see, and do I want to engage, okay? And that depends, that's my perspective as an individual. And that really depends on the shared context that I'm looking at. And that context is shared with a group, right? This is social, so it's more than one person, it's more than two people. It's a canonical definition is it's more than two people. So I have a shared context with the group. And does it matter to me? Is it relevant to me? If yes, then I will engage. So relevance drives engagement. And once I engage, it feeds back potentially and likely into the value that others perceive and the relevance of the shared context to others. So that's a very nice flywheel, but you have to get it going, and you have to be mindful of it, right? So to give you one example, and then the shared context provides focus. That's the other thing. If you go to a place like the company feed at Microsoft, where we have 100,000 people sharing random thoughts. Okay, it is a shared context, and apparently there are enough people who care to post there, so they are engaged. They just want to share, but what's the focus of the conversation, right? There is none. So some people are finding it really hard to get value out of the company feed, which is one of the most fundamental constructs in social tools. And so the company feed, kind of to just close this out, the company feed becomes useful once you start using hashtags. Like if I want to comment on Windows 8, I can use the hashtag and somebody finds my posting, not because they're looking at the company feed, but they're subscribed to the topic. They're subscribed to the hashtag. And so the company feed is really a dumping ground where I go to without knowing who might be interested is for whom it may concern, right? That's the company feed, but it's not meant to be consumed directly if you're an organization of the size of Microsoft. So just to close out on the company feed. But this is very interesting because you have so many critical parameters here, like the size of the group. If you have a shared context that requires that people are really starting to interact with each other as individuals, then you have some constraints like the well-known Dunbar's number, where we know out of group sociological research that number is about 150 people. You cannot have meaningful relationships with more on average and so on and so forth. But what does it mean if the success of the shared context of the group depends on having 20,000 people collaborate? Huh. Interesting, right? And it really depends on the flavor of the group. So from research done on communities of practice, we know that communities of practice have been observed to be successful with up to 2,000 participants. Okay? Still not the 20,000, but 2,000, that seems still to be viable for a group. But then at some point, you really get to where this becomes the equivalent of the company feed again. Like the one social community at Microsoft that has not been migrated over to Yammer yet, as far as I know, is the photographers of Microsoft, which is a group of 60,000 people. Okay? So it's more like, okay, I'm looking for a discount on a Canon zoom lens, so let's look if somebody posted something in the group. So again, it's more like a dumping ground and not necessarily a shared context with interactions back and forth. So this is important. It's really important to also realize that if you care ultimately about value, then the relevance of the shared context has to transcend beyond the individual and even the group into something the organization cares about. Clearly, this is later on in the maturity stage, but this is the end game. And you can, as we will see later, you can impact that and how it plays out if you design that context. If you shape it to have a specific focus, then ultimately at a relatively high level of maturity, you will be able to create an alignment between the focus of the shared context and business objectives. Okay? So you start out really with driving it as generating relevance, getting people to come on board, and then later on you can get very serious about value creation. Behavior. So there's some very, very good news for all of us here. When I started out to look at social, I tried to really understand what is behind this notion of designing a shared context that would be successful in providing relevance to the group and the individual. There's a lot going on there, clearly. It turns out that there's a discipline called organizational design that is effectively based on a researcher, Kurt Lewin. He did most of his work in the late 1930s and early 40s. He passed away in 44. But he came up with this field theory that has been very widely used ever since in a number of different ways. And his fundamental stipulation is that if you want to understand behavior or design behavior, which we want with those shared contexts, then you have to look at the place itself, the life space, the topology or whatever you want to call it. You have to look at group dynamics and you have to look at the needs of the individual. So you cannot really do one in isolation and succeed. You have to look at the combination and the mutual back and forth between those factors. and then, according to him, taken together, that even leads to the ability to mathematically describe behavior in any given context, which not everybody subscribes to. But I wanted to call out that these factors are really important, and where technology sits, it's really part of this notion of design spaces or topology of contexts, if you will. And to make this real for you, here's a very recent example, right? So with Sandy, what we saw is really how much a shared context can shape everybody's behavior. And there was a lot of amazing behavior there, where people just stepped up and they would just come forward and help their neighbors and help people who needed help. It came down to you had something that you were able to share, and then you would do that and even advertise it to others so they would know that you could help them. And there are numerous examples of this, right? So this is a very strong example of where effectively the circumstances become the overarching factor, not so much who you are and what you do for a living and if you're rich or poor or the color of your skin or something like that. It's really circumstantial. In other cases, as you're trying to understand the magic behind successfully creating context, in other places you might find it valuable to go back to the notion of persona-based research. If you want to create a community of practice for people who are SharePoint experts, right, then you would automatically be able to make certain assumptions about the style and flavor and nature of that community. Maybe you would, even the technical decision to do it on SharePoint rather than on Yammer, if you're talking to some SharePoint geeks. So you have to be aware of those choices, and sometimes one of these buckets can really dominate the others. What you can never rule out is really group dynamics, and you always have to cater to the needs of the individual. That's certainly always true. To give you, again, trying to move away from the academic stuff that again, is based in very old, very well-understood theory, here's an example, an interesting example that I found this morning on group dynamics. So somebody is posting to the company feed, and they're using a hashtag, SharePoint 2013. And, then somebody jumps in and says, oh, yeah, please review this discussion, right? So there's no heavy-handed moderation. Just a friendly pointer. Please review this discussion. And then this is. Look at what happened between 8:15 and 3:19 in the afternoon. Look what happened here in terms of group dynamics. So first of all, somebody has a suggestion what to do rather than to use SharePoint. And Connie provides some background info on why that's a bad idea, right? If you're just doing a demo, then you're not talking on topic about SharePoint 2013, which is a legitimate topic in its own right. So you're polluting it. Then the community helps to validate that statement. So people like it. So people chime in, well said, true. Somebody takes a step further and says, oh, yeah, and by the way, if you want to tag it, just use SharePoint demo. Then there's no confusion. And then Nate comes in and he one-ups that suggestion and says, yeah, and it's even better if you create a standalone site for demo purposes and just post it there rather than to the company feed at all. That's actually the best solution. Okay? And so this is very, very interesting. There was no explicit communication to anybody. Hey, Mr. Administrator, we've got a problem here. You have to call somebody to order. They're polluting our company feed. That would have never worked. So this is one of the nice sides of social, where a lot of what you care about happens almost automatically. So that's nice. There's a point to be made. So you still have to, I will get to this a bit later, you should still have clear rules and just be transparent about expected behavior. But if you are getting too heavy-handed, if you are trying to run this like SAP and be very prescriptive and micromanage it, then you will find an angry mob at your hand, as one of our researchers said in a somewhat provocative blog article. So social norms really emerge in a place over time, and there's something really important here. First impressions and early adopters really matter. So if you are, again, I told you, you're getting a lot for free, and I just showed you an example of how the community is taking care of their own matters. But if you care, if you really care about a life space, a social place, then chances are, if you are unlucky, it might start out with the wrong group of people. People may be just bullying, or they only want to talk about themselves, or something is just not going in the right direction. Somebody has a preconceived idea, hey, you're not allowed to use this hashtag, so I will call you out and police you and slap you and say bad things about you. So then you're killing engagement. And then the next people who even looks at that community and conversation, they will pick up on the tone and they will make a choice that they do not want to be part of it. They don't want to participate. So the social norms that are part of the dynamics of social places really, really have a heavy dependency on who gets there first and how that culture emerges until it reaches a stable state where you have a handful of regular contributors and so on and so forth. So then it becomes clear what the cultural norms of a place are supposed to be, and it's also clear that those are friendly and welcoming. So I put a lot of more text on the slide here for you to read. It's a very, very insightful analysis involving some of the biggest names on the internet and why they were successful with something they did and why they weren't. And interestingly, one more thing here that's really important. The real name culture on Facebook didn't unfold because it was a policy. It really happened that people came on board and they used their real names, and that became the norm of the place. And then later on, it was formalized, right? But it really started out that way. Where on other places, it's actually very important to use cool nicknames. So that's kind of, but then it's a different place. Okay, and the two don't mix and match well, because then the people using real names will get attacked by the people using pseudonyms, and there's even a theory about that on the internet. So how do you design those life spaces? Again, early adopters matter. The social norms, the cultural norms matter. You have to be clear about expected behavior. And I guess that all of us, for compliance purposes, do have a corporate email policy. So you tell people, write emails as if you expected your email to be published on the front page of the New York Times. Right? That's kind of the gist of a lot of corporate email policies. You have to be clear because people get confused. They're using social tools in their private lives. And again, depending on which community is their favorite destination in their personal life, they might just take some of the cultural norms from there and start behaving in the same way in the corporate space. So you have to have rules. You have to have private spaces. It's not always appropriate to have conversations out there in the public. So you have to have a really balanced approach. Again, a lot of this is driven by compliance, but some of it is actually also going back to, you do not want one person with their negativity to take over a place and destroy the experience for everybody else. So you can really help to avoid disappointments if you help to establish a sense of purpose, direction, and rules. You have to always meet the individual's needs. And again, the first principle is, why should they care? Right? So clearly what everybody hopes to get out of social is access to expertise. That's one of the most important use cases I'm hearing about from customers. But you can do better. You can do gamification. You can, and this has shaped all culture. Right? So we have this kudos application, even predating our mainstream social efforts, where if somebody did something nice for you, you have 160 characters or 140 characters to say thank you, and then it gets sent to them and to their manager, and it's posted on a leaderboard. And that's just so much less awkward as compared to writing a lengthy email and copying in their manager and here's what you did for me and thank you. It's so much easier to say thank you, but the effect is almost the same as writing that long email and taking half an hour, and this takes 2 minutes. So this idea of gamification, a reward system, positive amplification, that's a big one. And then also the participation in non-hierarchical conversations. Again, be very careful when to bring on board your executives with a social initiative. I've heard stories about a CEO, they wrote a blog post, and 20 people read it, and one person commented, and the CEO felt that they were embarrassed, right? Because nobody, very visibly, nobody cared about what they had to say. So be mindful in bringing in your top executives in the early stages of your social adoption. On the other hand, this is a great opportunity, for example, for our chief people officer. She's an active participant, and so she's just using this from day one as we're growing our own adoption to extend her opportunity to solicit employee feedback. She would travel around the world and do those in-person events and talk to groups of 20 people. Now she can talk to 100,000 people. So that's actually a very, very nice incentive for her, but then it lends credibility to the platform and to using these tools because you have validation, you see it in action, and there is actually, you know that it's making its way to the top. Disincentives, super important. Lack of trust. Trust is the number one word here. Oftentimes, frequently, there is a lack of trust. You post something and you're exposing yourself, right? Every single time you post something, you have an opportunity to make a new enemy or look foolish or something along those lines. So you have to feel that this is a safe environment and that what you do here is not going to end up being used against you in your annual review with your performance review with your manager. So lack of trust, this is super important. It's not an easy, it's a big rock. It's not an easy thing that's getting in the way. Unfriendly attitudes, I talked about that already. Fear of prejudice against social network participation. I've heard that actually. This is real world where somebody told their employees, wow, I see that you're using these social tools a lot. I'm not convinced that you have enough time left for your day job. So stop using the social tools, right? So it's a big cultural thing, but I've seen this more than once. Technology can help. So again, going back to how do you design those spaces to be relevant? You can use search. And this is kind of obvious, right? Finding people, finding content, targeting people with content that matters to them. I've received feedback from some organizations. They weren't interested in employee engagement at all, but they told me they wanted to do social. So what were they talking about? Their focus was just to be relevant without necessarily asking for feedback, but being more relevant and being able to reach out to employees in a more efficient manner. So that is certainly, if you're looking at the algorithmic search-delivered page content, I now can target content directly to you with some of these modern technologies. Feels like personalized shopping on Amazon. Recommendations, right? So if you are looking at something that we know that you're interested in, why don't I show you adjacent people, pages, documents? It's actually very meaningful to drive relevance. Metadata and hashtags. If information is qualified, then you have a greater chance of picking up relevant information across organizational silos. So finding spaces that are relevant because the information in there is calling out to you. Making it really seamless and easy. So the device of your choice, being able to look inside of a document to see if it's relevant, those things that technology can really help with. So technology does matter. This is about how you would implement social in your organization. So I would call out four different categories. This is slightly different than Gartner's view. They have three categories, but there's a general thing that you will see in the industry that people are trying to call out different classes of social. And so this is my attempt, and I'll talk about what's really in here. The color coding does work on this slide. On the left-hand side, you would see those things that really have the point of view of being about organizational design. Again, this goes back to Kurt Levine. This goes back to sociological insights. This goes back to a strategic universal approach. And it still matters for the other ones, but this is kind of the primary pivot in those scenarios. You can take that as a primary pivot and just go about in creating a social organization. So that is group-centric and user-centric. And then you have the other half of the spectrum where there definitely is a school of thought that starts with application-centric or marketing-centric approaches. And those are completely different as a primary implementation vector for social compared to the other two. So looking at what's in here, I would ask you to pay particular attention to what's on the bottom of the slide. So what do you want, what can you achieve in pursuing a particular implementation strategy? So with group-centric social, if you look at formal groups, and if you're just looking at creating a Yammer group for your team or for your business unit or even for a V team or for a project, which is really best practice, so go do it. Not saying that you can't or you shouldn't. The primary payback, the primary benefit is going to be centered around the notion of efficiency. Okay, you're going faster. You're making fewer mistakes. It's really great. But it will not automatically give you innovation or new stuff, right? It's a beautiful tool, and you don't have to even change your culture. The culture change is maybe in adoption of the tool, but not really in changing the behavior and kinds of conversations that you're having. It's very easy, so that's good. Then you have social groups, and this is where you have to invest a lot more to take this off the ground. I'm finding the example of communities of practice to be a very interesting one because there are about four decades of systematic research, right? So it was a big buzzword about two decades ago, maybe, communities of practice before the current social hype. So you do have a lot of very, very well-founded research and insights and case studies and expertise. I'm pretty sure in all of your organizations, there's somebody who has undertaken an effort to figure out how to run communities of practice effectively. Very important, those are not identical to your formal groups or formal organization. Those are different. And so you will find some insights, like the average age of successful communities of practice is 6 years. So don't cry if they go away after 6 years. It's just established how those things change, how they evolve, how they are sponsored, how they are initiated. There's a lot of well-understood practices about how to do this. So this is where you're getting a completely different ROI, right? So the gain to be had here is around innovation and business transformation. Completely different. You start out with a different group that is constituted differently, that works according to different rules. So you will find that you're getting different outcomes. So be clear about which outcome you want. And then from that, look at what do you have to do to drive that outcome. Friends at work, informal networks. So this is important as well. So you could call that employee retention. You could call that employee satisfaction. This is actually an important aspect in the general adoption of the platform. No matter what else you're doing, this is a frequently asked question. Should I shut down conversations about baseball, right? If there's a group for that, the answer is quite clear. No, you shouldn't, because it's in your best interest to keep people engaged on that conversational platform and then being able, besides talking about baseball, to also get back to those business conversations. So that's the group-centric. The user-centric social is equally important. And this is again, a lot of these scenarios work in conjunction, but you should be clear, again, look at it from the perspective of the outcomes. So the acceptance for communicating and being engaged, that depends on meeting your communication preference. This is why mobile device support is so important for social. This is, on the other hand, this is why it's so important to be able to have people who are only using Outlook also be engaged in social conversations and being able to reply if they're at mentioned and being able to be inclusive. So the personal preference is super important. And then you're getting to some of these technology enablers where you have new work styles, you have telecommuting and those things, where again, you will find that social has some particularly interesting qualities, as you saw in that real conversation I showed you earlier, when they talked about hashtags. that was disconnected across geographies, across time zones, and was just a very efficient dialogue conducted using these tools. And I bet you that the same people would not have engaged in the same conversation using any other technology or platform. Digital self. This is not often enough discussed in the context of enterprise social networks. This is quite clearly the number one reason behind the existence of Facebook, right? So you want to share success. You want to share with others. The reason on the professional side, the reason why LinkedIn exists is that it's all about self-promotion. So inside of the company, the same is true. I did a session on social with Jared Spataro, who you all know from the keynote, right? We did a session together in July. They put us in a conference center in the remote corner of the earth. People had to walk 20 minutes to get to our session, which was the last session of the day on day 4 of the conference. So what did we do? We advertised it on Yammer, and we were the only session, because Yammer was brand new back then, the only session who did so, and we had people had to be turned away at the door. So this reputation management, this aspect of advertising something good that you're about to do or have done to others, that's a big driver for engagement as well. And so this is all about engagement. And you will see that this is important. People are doing this all the time in their personal life, and this can be highly productive in the enterprise as well. User-centric. Now, this is different, and this is where we move from the green part of the color spectrum to the red part. And this is where, if all of what I just told you, you have a feeling it doesn't apply to your organization, this is the magic bullet, right? So I talked to a big logistics company, and you are all customers or have had interactions with that company. And they have hundreds of thousands of truck drivers. They all are heavily unionized, so they feel like, okay, the truck driver delivers 100 parcels per day or something amazing like that. And it's all very highly automated. And I talked to the operations research person in charge of these core processes. And he was like, nah, I don't need a virtual water cooler. So where it got a lot more interesting to him was when I said, yeah, well, but what do you do when you have an exception? When you have something that's going wrong, maybe there's a traffic jam, maybe there's something else that somebody, it's getting in the way of work being done. How do you capture that in your tools and processes so that others can see that, okay, the problem has already been reported and actions are being taken in a contextual manner, right? So how do you bring that to life where at each step of the process, there actually is the notion of being able to share observations, provide feedback, and see what others have to say about the same thing. Again, this is the difference between saying, okay, I just tweeted about this yesterday. The NVIDIA 302.80 driver crashes under Windows 8. Okay, so now I've saved all of you a call to help desk to report in on the problem, because you kind of know that it has been reported already. And so I use Twitter, so there was no reply from NVIDIA. I'm waiting for that. If somebody here works for NVIDIA, please reply. But then you see the reply. So you see, okay, it will be fixed in the driver that's coming out on the 20th, right? So embedding that into the context of your processes is really super powerful. And it's always been a shortcoming of easily repeatable processes, also known as ERP, that the way that you're dealing with exceptions, that's always just not well supported. And then also, how do you capture feedback, right? What I hate the most about our corporate internet, as of a year ago, it's starting to get better, so kudos to the people working on it, but it used to be completely static. So there's a piece of content that's 3 years old and worthless and outright dangerous. But I cannot provide that feedback. I cannot see to it that it gets fixed. I could kind of spend an hour try to figure out who owns it. And well, no, they have left the company. Huh, tough luck. So this is really every single thing that you do, if you just provide the ability to give feedback, that's a very interesting augmentation strategy that doesn't cause you to rethink your existing landscape, your existing applications, but it's just a very natural way of extending those capabilities. And you do not have to think about group dynamics or catering to the needs of the individual and psychology and sociology. You can just augment your applications, which should appeal to a lot of the IT people in the room, right? Also depending on what your mandate is, what your higher-ups expect you to do with social, there's a lot of value that you can get in a more or less mechanical way by just adding those tools to your existing landscape. And I'm trusting that you've all seen how ridiculously easy that is with Yammer, right? Information out, information in. A business user can embed a Yammer context into a SharePoint in 30 seconds. Okay, so SharePoint is particularly nice to be able to do this. So the other one is transparency. Again, it's more a cultural decision. Do you want to share? Do you want to be transparent and open? If yes, then collaborative decision making is here for you. But it all starts with sharing the underlying data. And are you comfortable with doing that at a larger scale or no? If the answer is no, and it will be no for a lot of you, then this whole thing is just not going to work. But, so you have to look at those prerequisites before you just start a fancy social initiative. And then there are business reasons for why you aren't allowed to proceed. And of course, social search. It's also about finding information. This is deceptively simple at the surface, but then if you don't properly secure access to your information, or if you are being too restrictive, like some of you I know, they are so restrictive that nobody can see anything besides the documents that they created themselves, and they're still using SharePoint amazingly. So if you are too tight on access controls, then again, this is just it's not going to work for you. So if you have the fundamental willingness to be transparent, then social tools can help you with knowledge management. Okay. So moving on, this is I'll go a bit faster on this. This is well understood, marketing-centric social. There's a lot that you can do, again, focusing on the impact. Reach and impact. We are all exposed to this. Sometimes it can even get annoying how marketeers are using social tools to get at us, to go after us. More interestingly, this notion of customer dialogue, right? Again, as part of this session, I want to make this real for you as much as I can. At Microsoft, we have this community that you are able to meet actually here at SharePoint Conference, some of them, called Most Valuable Professionals, MVPs. And some of you might even be MVPs in this room. What we've done here is just to look at how can we have an impact on social communities. And so we found those external champions, community contributors. They're not on our payroll, but we're actively managing them. We are giving them early access to information. We used to fly them over to Redmond to meet with Bill Gates once a year. That level of access, just to keep them engaged and reward them for their contribution, and they're having a massive impact for us out there with our communities. So this is another design point, right? Always think about who is your champion going to be within a given community, and then again, you have to be able to justify that investment based on the business impacts you're looking to drive. Okay, so you have many choices here, and very likely you will have a tendency to gravitate towards not all of them, but to be able right here, right now, after what I told you, to have a view, an opinion about what flavor of social is the most likely one that your organization will want to embrace. The good news, so all of this is more or less strategic. The good news is that there's a tactical approach as well. And so I'm going to compare and contrast the two for you. And it depends on any number of factors. How much money do you have? Who is driving the project? Does it originate with the business or with IT? What is the expected lifetime? Is this a time-limited engagement? Do you want the social project done in 6 months and that's the end of the engagement? Or is this a sustained effort? What's the cultural fit? What do you currently have, right? So sometimes, paradoxically, the worse off you are today, with collaboration and communication, the more attractive it becomes to jump onto a social platform right away, because it will substitute for a lot of capabilities that you're currently missing. So running social as a project, here's a nice three-page article, but a lot of good ideas here from Harvard Business Review last year. they are different. They came up with different classifications, and I've added some dollar signs here. So there is, and they have some on the right hand column. There's some customer examples. So you can just do a very selective thing, and like build a platform for idea exchange with customers. Fine, that's a very selective engagement. That doesn't change your corporate culture or rock the boat, but you can actually get benefits out of it. You can do experiments. And then if those work, that's fine. But it's very opportunistic, right? So you just hey, turn on Yammer, get going, right? So again, EMC, they always, on any case study they do, they always have those amazing ROIs. So I really like them for that. They saved 127 million out of using Office over 4 years. So in this case, social saved them another 40 million. So just by doing a more or less an employee engagement platform, then you can start making it your own, and you can deliberately design a very specific use case for social. Like when Ford, they brought to market the new Fiesta, they had a handful of cars, I believe 100 cars, it says on the slide. They handed those over to customers with the obligation that customers were supposed to blog about their experiences field testing the new car. And so they got more than 60,000 blog articles out of this and a lot of YouTube airtime. And so with a $5 million campaign, they actually had an impact that they typically would have gotten from a $50 million campaign, right? By just taking advantage of social media in a very, very deliberate manner. And then you can say, hey, this is a bigger platform. Like Cisco is an example here. I cannot promise you that they're using SharePoint. Again, this is just from Harvard Business Review. There was no mention of technology ever. But they really went about changing their corporate engagement platform. So this is actually the most expensive one out of the four. And this is moving more in a strategic direction. But it's still limited scope. So you will not do anything necessarily beyond that. You will create that platform, and then you will move on, and you will declare victory on the project. This definitely works, and we have any numbers of customers who have succeeded with that. Then social as a strategy is different. Social as a strategy, you start with a view on building a portfolio of objectives, right? What matters the most to you? Make money, save money, drive opportunities and innovation, okay? Just along these lines, and I put in some examples here, what you could be shooting for. But just do a very open-minded assessment, what are the company's priorities now, and then apply that broadly and look at what do you want to do to get there. So starting with just doing a company-wide rollout with Yammer that takes you 5 minutes, and then how do you move on? What additional steps are you planning? Because, you know, this is strategic. You're not just going to turn it on. You're trying to move ahead a little bit further. And then try and establish some milestones. Again, I gave you the example at the very beginning, our acquisition of Yammer. That is now, this experience is transforming the way that our merger and acquisitions team is looking at future acquisitions. This becomes part of the way of their core competency in how Microsoft does acquisitions, is in using social platforms to manage the integration process. So look at some of those things that are really important at a very broad scale across the company. Look at the health of networks. And I'll talk a bit about what it takes. But this is important to realize that health is an ongoing concern. You have this measure of a sustained engagement where the ratio between people who start a conversation, who reply to a conversation, and who are just reading the conversation is at a certain mathematical ratio. So you have that down here. If you are at that stage, you're still at the risk of the community just fading away, right? There's something else big happening. So the community may take a hit, or it might flourish even more, but it's sustained, but you have to actively invest into moving it forward. Then you have you have the opportunity to take it forward. And again, there's some measures. And moving to a fully integrated state where there's no question anymore that this is just as natural to use in your company as you would use Outlook or Office. So the tipping point for this adoption, this is interesting in my mind because there's some best practices here. The tipping point would be, according to me, departmental use, where you cannot stand still once you've gotten there. You still have to actively push forward to move to the next level. But at this stage, you've outgrown your first baby steps and encouragement, and people are really starting to use it. So this is where you start introducing success measures. You start trying to identify business value. You have some best practices that you can share. Actually, this is super important. People need constant encouragement. They need to hear that it's worth doing it. It's worth engaging. They need to hear about successes. Everybody, after day one of Yammerizing your company, after the first day, you will already find examples where you will have a number of people saying, I didn't think this would work. I asked a question. I got an answer within 5 minutes. I'm fully on board now. You will find those examples. I guarantee it. So what you should do is to evangelize those examples, to keep them alive, to make sure that nobody forgets that there's value, and then also trying to shape, again, these digital spaces and the engagement and trying to build and nurture communities and then taking that success, package it up, and reshare it again and share it more broadly. So the other trick is here, put content inside of social channels. If the only way you can get my presentation is to go to my social community, I bet if you want the presentation, you'll come and you'll take a look and I've got you hooked, right? So this is actually an interesting aspect where you can place some nuggets there, and if people want to come collect the nuggets, they are a step closer to taking a look and maybe even participating in your community. Okay, define outcomes and accountabilities. This is just, I don't have to read this to you. We don't have all the time in the world, as much as I regret it. So again, try and shoot for specific outcomes. Have identified champions, so people who you are supporting, who you are coaching and helping them to drive this particular social space, and identify who's the sponsor, right? Who's interested in the outcomes and would be willing to help out to sustain it and to nurture it. Prioritize your use cases, that's clear, right? So this is a critical slide. None of the enablers are really negotiable. If you are aiming for a strategic implementation of social, you have to have all of these on board. You have to have the notion of a group of people, this is just a fancy term, a steering committee. You have to manage social holistically, taking into account some of the factors I shared with you. So this is really important. The lack of information on is it useful, what are the risks, how are we going to do it, how do I get started, the lack of uncertainty there is just going to kill so many opportunities to get value out of social. If you have a visible, centralized function where people can turn to and they get a rationalized view, an end-to-end view of how this is supposed to work and what the outcomes might be and the success stories, that is going to be really helpful. Trust is key. Again, this is back to one of our early adopters, Aviva. They became a social company in 2008 with our BPOS dedicated offering based on SharePoint 2007. So if you think that social requires the latest and greatest tools, think again. It's definitely possible to be super successful using yesterday's tools. And again, some good learnings here on how the governance and self-management aspect worked out. By the way, again, one of the reasons why I talked a bit about sociology is that there are some very well understood learnings from looking at group dynamics and efficiency where you don't have to figure this out yourself. Either autocratic or laissez-faire groups, so too much heavy-handed control or no control, are less performant than democratic groups, right? So again, you can comfortably just take that and just make that a part of your approach, how you're going to go about your own social initiative. Value and scope, and this is a fitting closing of this session. Value and scope. Just by turning on Yammer, you have instant gratification. And this is not just a marketing slogan. You will see this cross-pollination of ideas and people helping out each other across your organization. It doesn't take everybody to participate. If you have 1% of your employees, maybe even the millennials only, they will be able to create connections and referrals. So you will see opportunistic value out of just starting to use it. Then, as you're moving on, and this is really maybe the six-month goal, then as you're starting to typify and categorize the kinds of social that you want to encourage to happen in the organization, you will start to see that it's driving business value. So save money, make money. And then the other one is this is the highest value, according to our friends at Gartner, is if you are sufficiently mature in your internal adoption that you can consider to extend it to external parties, to partners and customers. Because there's always this collaborative friction as you're trying to cross the borders of your organization. And again, there's some pointers here. So summary, decide on your fundamental approach. Do you feel that it is feasible for you to pursue it as a strategic initiative? Then, okay, this is kind of what I believe over time is going to happen anyway. But for now, you also have the option, the opportunity, if you don't have the mandate to go big, to drive really lighthouse projects and win in a more tactical manner. You can, so this corresponds well to the aspect of organization design versus application enhancement. Application enhancement, start doing it tomorrow. Yammer embed. You're all good, right? So organization design, a lot more stakeholders will want to be involved. And it's more difficult to pull off. You should consider that through end-user-led adoption with Yammer and similar tools, you will have some sort of social culture anyways. So can you afford to not look at the organizational design? And then always check the relevance for the user. Does the particular environment that you provide or that exists stimulate engagement? And then start managing value at a certain point in your adoption. Don't put that burden onto your social collaborators on day one, but then as you're maturing, try and identify value as it gets created, best practices, but then also set up communities and nurture communities and ultimately create a linkage to business processes and core competencies such as the merger and acquisition capability. Then move it up and really build out a catalog of capabilities based on social. And that will help you over time to just pick and choose according to a business objective that you want to pursue. Reading list, this is kind of funny because the illustration on two of these books looks a bit similar. I don't know who copied from whom. This is just some of the fundamental works that I would encourage you to take a look at. I started with a list of 20 titles, and I just prioritized a little bit. So if you're looking for something to read on your flight back from SharePoint Conference, and if you want to go deeper on designing these workplace experiences for social, then those three books are really very, very high on my personal list, so I would recommend them. All right, thank you. Thanks for staying throughout this completely non-technical session. I hope I gave you some ideas. I hope you have some more questions out of this. I'll be here after this session is done, and again, looking forward to many more social conversations with all of you. Thank you.